Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome back to our Pirkei Avos class learning, Erev Shabbos. So just a reminder, I've been announcing this on my classes. Next week, we still have Shir Be'azrat Hashem. Next week, Thursday night, we will have Shir. That is the last Shir before we bake for Pesach. I can't imagine anyone would even be considering tuning in the Thursday night right before Pesach, but you never know. So I fill in a chais to announce the schedule. Tonight, there's Shir. Here we are. Next week, Be'azrat Hashem. Not everyone is muted, someone just told me. Thank you. 1 second. So tonight there's Shir, not everyone is muted. You're right. 1 second, please. Thank you. Tonight there is Shir. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, there's Shir. And then we break till the Thursday night after Pesach. So tonight we actually have three sponsors. Okay, I'm going to say them over in the order that I received them. Also, we're going to be continuing our topic of the theme, the overarching theme of Pirkei Avos, which is a life of Torah. And last time I thought I'd get to many more insights of Rav Chaim Kanievsky Zatzal on the Haggadah than I did. So tonight is a Haggadah Shir. We're going to be looking at different insights from different places in the Haggadah based on teachings from Harav Hagaon Rav Chaim Kanievsky Zecher Tzadav Kodesh Levrachos Chuso Yagein Aleinu. The first sponsor, in the order that I received them, is Alice Marks. Alice Marks learns with me in many different venues for many years, and she is sponsoring L'Zecher Nishmas her father, Shmuel Ben Yaakov, Alav Hashalom. His 38th Yahrzeit was 19 Adar Bet. May his neshama have an ali in the Zchus of the Torah that we will share this evening, and also in the Zchus of Alice's tremendous commitment to Limud HaTorah and Ahavas Torah, and I thank her very much for her sponsorship. The next sponsor is from our dear Pirkei Avos class friend, Susie Fonfetter, who's been with us, I think, and this year from the beginning. She was one of the original group. And she is sponsoring L'Zecher Nishmas, her father, Yehuda ben Moshe, Alav HaShalom. And the Yahrzeit is this Sunday, the 2nd of Nisan. She says it is almost Pesach. And every Pesach, she remembers that we used to discuss our leaving Hungary in 56 on Pesach. We escaped with nothing to America or Israel, wherever we would get the visa first to be able to keep Shabbos, and like my father would say, to be Erlich HaYidin. He had a tremendous love for his rabbis and for people who sat and learned Torah. He was a survivor with love for his fellow Jews. He was always on the giving end without us or my mother, Allah Hashem, knowing about anything that he did. He, Baruch Hashem, has doros of grandchildren and great-grandchildren of whom he would be extremely proud. May the Neshem of Yehuda ben Moshe, Allah Hashem, merit an aliyah, the schus of the Torah. We thank Susie Fonfetter for her being part of this year, almost, I think, from the beginning, and for her sponsorship. And one more last minute, which is for a simcha. Baruch Hashem, hodu l'Hashem ki tov, kili olam chasto. And that is from our friend Shoshana Pollack, who is sponsoring Baruch Hashem, hodu l'Hashem ki tov, kili olam chasto, in honor of a new baby boy born to the family. Shetizku l'gadu the Torah, u l'chupa, u l'maisim tovim, in good health, with only simcha and nachas. And we thank Shoshana Pollack very much for her sponsorship. With that as the amudim that hold up the Torah, let us get into our Torah learning. So again, we are going to continue insights into Rav Chaim Kanievsky Zatzal into the Haggadah Shel Pesach. Okay, we say in the section of Magid, Baruch Shomer Haftachaso L'Israel, blessed is he who guards or who keeps his promise to Israel. Baruch Hu, blessed is he. Shehakadosh Baruch Hu Chishev Etz Hakeit. Shehakadosh Baruch Hu calculated the end. So he knew when we went down to Egypt, we would not be there forever. La'asos Kemosh Amar La'Avram Avinu B'Bris Ben Absalom, like he promised to do to Avram in the Bris Ben Absalom. This passage in Magid is right after Yachol Me'Rosh Chodesh. Okay? Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zara Hayu Avoseinu. Right after that passage, we say, Baruch Shomer Haftachaso L'Yisrael, Baruch Hu, Shehakadosh Baruch Hu Chishev Etz Hakeit. I translated that already, so I'm not translating it again. La'asos Kemosha Amar La'Avram Avinu B'Bris Ben Absarim, to do like what he promised to Avram in the Bris Ben Absarim, Shenemar. And now the Haggadah quotes from Parak Tes Vav Abereshis, Vayomer La'Avram, and God said to Avram, Yodo Teda Ki Ger Yezarecha Be'eretz Olam, no, you shall surely know, your children will be strangers in a land that's not theirs. La'avadun Vinu Osam Ar arba meoshana, they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. Vagamas hagoy sher yavodu dan anochi, and also the nation that oppresses them, I will judge. Va'achareichein yitzu b'chush gadol, and after they will leave with very great wealth. Rav Chaim Kanievsky speaks about here the fact that we refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as keeping his promise. We begin this passage with Baruch Shomer Haftachaso Yisrael. Blessed is he who guards or who keeps, who watches over his promise, his oath to Israel. Rav Chaim Zatzal explains this passage as follows. We are not simply thanking Hashem for keeping his pledge to redeem us from Egypt. After all, it was unthinkable that Hashem would not take us out once he pledged to Avraham Avinu to do so. So it's not simply that we're thanking Hashem for taking us out. Rather, we're thanking Hashem for making the promise to take us out in the first place. So of course, once God made the promise, he was going to take us out. What we're thanking him for is the fact that he made the promise to Avraham Avinu that he would have children, that he would have descendants, that he would have Zar Chai V'Kayama, who though they would go down to Egypt, would eventually be redeemed. Moreover, we are proclaiming that we recognize that unlike human beings, kings and rulers, who promise and do not fulfill their promises, how true that is about human rulers, politicians, those in authority. They make promises and they do not fulfill their promises. Unlike human beings, Hashem keeps his pledges, even though there is no one compelling him to do so. Hashem keeps his promise. And this reminds me of what the Gemara says in Masachas Shabbos. The Gemara says in Masachas Shabbos 55a, 55, actually I shouldn't say if it's Amar Aleph or Beis, Shabbos Nun Hei. And the Gemara says there that the Chos Moshe HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Emes. The seal of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is truth. And we know that when you look at the Aleph Beis, the first, middle, and last letter of the Aleph Beis spell the word Emes, truth. Because the Midah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the seal of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is truth. And so we're blessing Hashem who is truthful, who is truthful, who keeps his word when he says so. Rav Chaim often, and what does this all mean for us? What is the lesson here? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the Malame Torah La'am. Rav Chaim often stresses the importance of absolute honesty and repeats the statement in Sefer Chassidim that if someone is scrupulously honest, the blessings that he gives will be fulfilled, which is so interesting because now, as we read more and more about Rav Chaim, the blessings that he gave were fulfilled and were came to fruition. An honest person is emulating the Ribbono Shel Olam, and just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shomer Havtachaso Yisrael, and his blessing becomes fulfilled, so the honest person, the amistic person, has the power that his blessings become fulfilled. Anyone who speaks the truth and does not speak falsely, not even in his mind, all his words will be fulfilled. He can decree something and Hashem will fulfill it. As the Pasuk says, in Eov, you would utter a decree and it will be done. We know we have a principle that Tzadik goes around Kosh Baruch Hu Mekayim. A Tzadik says something and Kosh Baruch Hu is forced, so to speak, to uphold the reality that the Tzadik has made. When a person lives an emistic life, he is emulating the Choseim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore he too has the power to promise and see his promises fulfilled, just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who was Shomer Haftachaso Yisrael. And this particular insight ends with the following vignette. Very powerful. I told this over to my family the other night. Someone came to Rav Chaim with a long list of questions. After answering a good number of questions, Rav Chaim said, "How many more questions do you have?" The guest, afraid that his audience was almost over, said, "Just one more question." Rav Chaim answered, "Very well, ask." He asked the next question. He received the answer and he quickly asked another one. To which Rav Chaim replied, "Sheker, dishonesty, that I cannot allow," and he refused to answer another question. Baruch Shomer Haftachaso Yisrael, blessed is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who not only redeemed us, but made the promise to redeem us, and not only made the promise, but took us out at the exact time that he said, and it comes to teach us a lesson. We must be Adam Yashar and Adam Kasher. Rav Shamsher Fal Hirsch, Zatzal, who died in 1888 in Germany, Rav Shamsher Fal Hirsch said, a person must be Adam Kasher and Adam Yashar. You have to be kosher before the Ribbono Shel Olam, and you have to be yashar with your fellow human beings. And of course, part of being yashar, a big part of being yashar, is encapsulating the midah of emes, for which we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for on Leil HaSeder. Moving on. Okay, Rav Chaim tells an explanation and a parable from the first I need to say, If it's so important, the Midah of Emes, then how could Moshe ask for a 3-day journey in the desert? We're only going for 3 days, but really they were not only going for 3 days. How long were they going for? Forever. So if this Midah of Emes is of such paramount importance, how could Moshe Rabbeinu say we're going for 3 days? And then they were planning to run away. So I once heard a very nice pshat from Rabbi Zev Lev more recently. Rabbi Zev Lev said a very nice answer to this, because when it was Mida Kenega Mida, when Paro tricked the Jews, he said, come to work for 1 day, it's good for the economy, I'm going to pay you. He used his words to ensnare them and trick them into the Shibar Mitzrayim, and therefore Mida Kenega Mida, words were used against him to trick him into Yetzias Mitzrayim. Rav Chaim Kanievsky says something very different, which relates to this idea of making promises. Rav Chaim tells an explanation from the Dubno Magid. Just this morning, I quoted also from Rav Chaim Sagada by Dayenu, also a mashal from the Dubno Magid. Hashem told Moshe to ask Paro to permit a 3-day journey into the desert, after which the Jews would return to Egypt. We only want to go for 3 days, then we're going to come back here. We're going to have a Yantef. Excuse me. However, Hashem clearly intended to free the Jews completely from their salvation. Why did Moshe ask only for a 3-day journey? The final destruction of the Egyptians took place on the 7th day of Pesach. We know Shvi Isha Pesach was Kriyas Yamsuf, and the Egyptians drowned. When they were all drowned in Yamsuf, only then, when their former masters were dead, after Shvi Isha Pesach, were the Jews truly free. It was contingent, their first freeing of Egypt, their first Yitzhak, was really contingent on Yitzhak's Mitzrayim. We were only truly free after Shvi Isha Pesach. We know Hashem calculates the exact time, the Gemara tells us in Sota, when a nation deserves to be destroyed, and He will not punish them before that time. Since the Egyptians were destroyed on the 7th day of Pesach, the time for their destruction must not have arrived until then. So it means they weren't ready to be totally annihilated till the 7th day of Pesach. If so, why did the Bnei Israel leave earlier? A week before? Why not just wait that we should leave? If they're really not ready for their total punishment until the 7th day of Pesach, why did we leave a week before on the 1st day of Pesach? So Rav Chaim answers, the Jews in Egypt had sunk to an extremely low spiritual level. The sages teach if they had remained in Egypt, even for one more moment, they would have sunk so low, spiritual redemption would have been impossible. It's something we've heard and it's something that we know. Hashem had to take them out at that exact moment or there would be no nation to take out anymore. Then he couldn't keep the promise to Avraham Avinu, Baruch Shomer Haftachaso Yisrael, but he couldn't keep the promise to Avraham if there was no nation to take out anymore. However, as mentioned, it wasn't yet time for the Egyptians to be destroyed. So it was time, the exact time for Bnei Israel to be saved, but it wasn't the exact time for the Egyptians to be redeemed. So what should we do? Hashem told Moshe, ask for 3 days. When the Jews did not return after 3 days, the Egyptians then caught up with them. And when they arrived at Yamsuf at the exact designated time for their destruction. So Hashem is chishev etz haketz, exactly. He's chishev the ketz for Klal Yisrael. Exactly when we need to leave, we will leave. We couldn't wait a second more or we would never have gone the Torah. We wouldn't have been a nation. We would have been totally lost into the tomb of Egypt. But it doesn't mean the Egyptians were ready for punishment yet. They were not totally ready to be finished off until the 7th day. So Kosh Baruch Hu was able to redeem Klal Yisrael at the exact time they needed, and not punish the Egyptians totally until the exact time they needed. It was able to do both simultaneously by asking for a 3-day journey. We journeyed for 3 days, then it took 3 days extra for them to realize we're not coming back, 3 days. Then it took 3 days for them to catch up. On the 7th day, they drowned in Yamsuf. Once the Egyptians were destroyed, their possessions became the property of the Jews. Like I quoted the passage, V'achreichein yetzu b'rechush gadol, after we will leave with great wealth. After what? After the Egyptians drowned by Yamsuf, we will get their great wealth. However, since the Jews left early, in a sense, we didn't deserve the possessions yet. We left when we had to leave, but it wasn't time for the Egyptians to be totally punished yet. Therefore, we asked for 3 days. By the 3rd day, they realized we're not coming back. It takes them 3 days to catch up. On the 7th day, they drowned when they were worthy of totally annihilation, and only then were their possessions ours. And therefore, we first borrowed, Vayishalu Ishmaes Reusa, Ishmaes Reusa, we borrowed their possessions first. 7 days later, when the Egyptians drowned in Yamsuf, it became our full property. And therefore, it truly is Baruch Shomer Haftachasol Yisrael in a way that a Basar Vadam cannot do. It was able to take out Klal Yisrael, Chishev Esaketz, exactly when we needed to leave, He was able to punish the Egyptians exactly when they needed to be punished. There was no stira between the two, and everyone got what they rightfully deserved. Klal Yisrael for Geula, the Egyptians for destruction, in exactly the right time. And again, the Mussar Has goes, obviously we cannot act, and it's impossible for us to be exactly like the Ribbono Shel Olam, but to go in his ways, to try to keep our promises to the best of our ability, and to be emistic and yashar and kosher, of course, to the very best of our ability. Moving on. In the Haggadah, we expound upon the verses actually from Kisavo and Mikra Bikurim. Okay? Arami Oved Avi comes from Devarim Peruch Avav. It does not come from Sefer Shmos. But then the Haggadah, the Bali Haggadah, expound upon Arami Oved Avi, the whole passage, based on the Psukim from Sefer Shmos. So therefore, in the middle of Magid, we say, Vayareu Osanu Hamitzrim, Vayanunu, Vayitnu Aleinu Avoda Kasha. And then Magid expands upon each phrase, Vayareu Osanu Hamitzrim, the Egyptians did evil to us, Vayanunu, they afflicted us, Vayitnu Aleinu Avoda Kasha. Again, I'm not focusing on one section of the Haggadah, which is what I did this morning. I'm specifically going through different places in the Haggadah, and I have chosen different insights of Rav Chaim to share as we journey through the Haggadah. Last week, remember, we did Halach Ma'anya, so we really started pretty much closer to the beginning. Vayareo sanu hamitzrim, the Egyptians did bad to us, and then what do we say? K'mosha nemar, like the Pasuk says, hava nischak malo, let us be wise, let us be cunning, let us be trickery against them. Pen yirba, lest they become many. V'haya kisikra ena mechama, this is from Shemos Perak Aleph, and it will be when war comes. V'nosaf gamhu al shonenu, I'm not quoting from Shemos, I'm quoting from the Haggadah though. And they will join with our enemies. V'nilcham banu, they, the Jews, will fight with us. This is the ancient blood libel against the Jews. They're not honest, they're not faithful, they're not worthy citizens, they're not loyal to the country. The enemy will come, they'll join with our enemy, and they'll kick us out of the land. And that's what the Baal Haggadah says, Vayareu Osanu HaMitzrim, means they did bad to us by slandering us, by putting out a propaganda machine, by saying that we'll join with the enemy and we'll turn against the Egyptians instead of being loyal to our host country. However, Rav Chaim tells over a well-known explanation, Vayareu Osanu Hamitzrim, the Egyptians did evil to us. And he is quoting the Shla HaKadosh. The phrase, the Egyptians did evil to us, would be more correctly written, Vayareu Lanu Hamitzrim. If you want to say the Egyptians did evil to us, you should say Vayareu Lanu Hamitzrim. What does it mean, Vayareu Osanu Hamitzrim? This phrase literally means, the Egyptians made us evil. Vayareu, is from the word ra, resh ayin. Vayareu osanu hamitzrim, the Egyptians made us evil. By using this phrase, the Torah is coming to teach us that besides the slavery, and besides the physical labor of the avodas parach, vayimaru as chayim, why we imara, besides with the tears, why we dip carpets in salty water, the Egyptians made us evil. By causing us to learn from their immoral and idolatrous ways, this was truly the worst thing the Egyptians did to us. Vayareu osanu hamitzrim means they made us evil. So how did they make us evil? So Rav Chaim writes or teaches that by learning from them immoral, their immoral ways and their ways of avodah zarah, that we became evil. But I think also one of the manifestations of galos is that sometimes Jews are unfortunately lacking in bein adam chaveiro. You might know it from personal experience or things that you read or things that you see in the political arena, the shul arena, the kehillah, the neighbors. At some times, we become evil towards each other. And sometimes our midos are so lacking. Perhaps it's because we're in galus, although that's what galus and galus in the first place. I don't know how we're going to reverse the equation if we continue that cycle. Vayareu osanu hamitzrim means that while we were there, we became evil. And that's the worst thing the Egyptians did to us. And it's a very strong Mr. Haska, I think, and a wake-up call and a lesson when you say these words in the Haggadah, that we have to be Adam Kashar and Adam Yashar. It's not enough to be kosher with God. It's not enough to be medaktik b'mitzvos bein Adam l'makom. It's important. Of course, eat the right share of matzah, eat the mara, make sure your home is clean, fulfill arba kosher, of course. Vayareu osanu hamitzrim, they made us evil, and too often that negativity becomes expressed towards our fellow Jew. And it's something to think about. And if you're involved in such a matzav, I hope not, you'll know the truism of what I speak. And we have to be extremely careful not to be made evil by the galus conditions in which we find ourselves. Moving on. I just let me see what page, because remember, I'm going through the Haggadah. Okay, moving on. After Vayireo Sanu Mitzrim, Vayanunu, Vayitnu, Aleinu, Avodakasha, Vayireo Sanu Mitzrim, Kamash Nehmar, Havan Ischak Malo, I read this to you already, Pen Yerbe, Vahayi Kisriku, Enim Elchama, Venosav Hu, Gam Also Neinu, Venocham Banu, Vala Minar. It continues in the Haggadah, Vayanunu, they oppressed us. So now the Baal Haggadah is expanding upon the next word, Kamash Nehmar, Vayosimu Alav Sarei Misim, they put upon them tax collectors, Lamana Nosu Bisivlosam, in order to afflict them with their burden, with their oppression, Vayivin Arei Miskanos the Paro, they built storage cities for Paro, I'm quoting from the Haggadah, as Pison ve'es Ramses. So I heard something very, very interesting this year, which I never heard, also from Rabbi Zavlev, going back months ago, but Ari Miskanos, like from the word Miskain. Miskain, like, is a Nebuch. Ari Miskanos, like, I don't know how you would even translate it, Nebuch into English, sorry, I think everyone knows what I'm saying. Ari Miskanos, sorry cities, such a sorry state of pitifulness. Why? Because whatever they would built would immediately sink down into the ground. So every day they would work and work and work, and the worst thing is to work and not see any fruits of your labor. If you don't work and you don't see fruits of your labor, you don't care, you didn't do anything. But if you work so hard and you put in your whole amelus and you don't produce results, that's the worst kind of oppression and the worst kind of work. Every day they would build these cities. They were built on quicksand and they would fall down into the ground. Ari Miskanos is Ari Miskanos. They were like Nebuch. Why? Because they would build and build and build. At least if you see the pyramid the next day, so at least you know you built something. You come back and it's sunk into the ground and you have to start all over again. It's futile labor. Someone said Miskanos is unfortunate. Okay. So, okay, Nabuch, unfortunate miskeina is a miskein. Vayiven are miskenos, the power is peace on Ves Ramses. Vayitnu aleinu avodah kasha. Then we continue, Kamasha Nehmar, Vayavidu Mitzrayim es b'nei Yisrael b'farach. And they put upon us hard work, like the Pasuk says, and the Egyptians enslaved b'nei Yisrael with farach. By the way, going back to that the Egyptians tricked us, so the Gemara says, in Masechta Sota, I think it's Yod Aleph, could be Yod Beis, Farach is a contraction of perach. Perach, soft mouth. They tricked us into slave labor by a soft mouth. They said, you're just coming to work for one day. We're going to pay you. It's good for the economy. Through that trickery, that soft mouth, they tricked us into working. So that is a pasuk again from Sefer Shemos. And if you look in the Chumash, you would see that the very next pasuk again repeats that they worked to avodas parach. So why does the Torah say two times in back-to-back psukim that we worked with avodas parach? Because we all know, because Michal Eretz repeats it all the time, that no word in the Torah is superfluous. So if you tell me one time that they worked the B'nai Yisrael with Parach, Shemos Parak Al Pasuk Yud Gimel, as we quote in Magi, then you don't need to tell me in the next Pasuk that they worked B'nai Yisrael with Parach, as Kol Vodosam Asher Avdu Behem Befarach. I know it's Parach, and you only need to tell me what. So the Gemara there has its own interpretation of why it's repeated twice, but Rav Chaim quotes the Medrash, explains as follows. Each Jew in Egypt was forced to make, I never saw this before, 600 bricks a day. That was their daily quota. 600 bricks a day. The gematria of the word parach, pei, resh, chaf, sofis, is 300. Pei is 80, resh is 200, and chaf is 20. 80 and 20 is 100, plus 200, you get 300. So parach in gematria is 300. Parach times 2 is 600, thus by repeating the word avodas parach, repeating the word parach, the verse is alluding to the daily quota of bricks that each Jew had to make, which was 600. Yeah, I don't like that quote from Golda Meir at all. I don't like it at all. I don't agree with it. I know I'm nobody, and she was prime minister of the state of Israel. I don't like it at all. She said, we can forgive you for killing our children, but we cannot forgive you for making us kill your children. I'm not masking. I don't agree. I don't think it's a Torah perspective. I don't like it. Let's go. Avodas parach. I shouldn't have even addressed the comment. I'm sorry. Pei, resh, chaf. Okay, well, this parach. Parach is 300. Why does it repeat it? Because parach times 2 is 600, and that's the daily quota of bricks. Once again, you see how every letter in the Torah is so important, and there's a message in everything. The Medrash also records, as quoted by Rav Chaim and Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, that the Jewish woman would come to work in the slave labor along with their husbands to help fill the daily quota. So therefore, according to this pshat, parach is repeated. Once it's for the men, they each made 300 bricks a day, and the second parach is for the woman. They would come help and they would make 300 bricks a day, and therefore the total is 600 bricks. This is a staggering number. Excuse me, when you think of the slave labor that they endured, it was tremendously oppressive conditions. It's something we can't comprehend of. It's such primitive conditions, working with their hands. And remember, they had to go out and gather their own straw starting in Perek Hay. And we have an idea here of how the Egyptians worked them so difficult, so unfairly, with such harsh slave labor. So what was the quota of bricks? Parach, 300 times 2, because they had to make 600 a day. Or, oh, not everyone's muted. How did that happen? Okay. 600 bricks a day, either as parach times 2, or the women came to help their husbands. The men made 300 a day, the women made 300 a day, equals 600, parach times 2. Moving on to the makos, okay? Of course, the makos play a central role in Yetzias Mitzrayim, in the decimation of Egypt, and in the Haggadah Shel Pasach. We all know this classic tune, which I'm not going to sing. Dam Sfardei Kinim Arav. We take out a little bit of wine from the cup. Rabbi Yehuda Haya Nasan Bem Simanim Detzach Adash Ba'achav. I'm going to talk about the first two, which is Dam and Sfardei, blood and frogs. Okay. So the pasuk tells us in regard to the makah of Dam, V'hadaga Asher Bayar Tamus, the fish life in the water will die. This is from Sefer Shemos, Perek Zion. Before the plague of blood, Moshe warned Paro that the fish in the river would all die. Why was it necessary for the fish to die? If you want to punish the Egyptians and give them blood, so why did the fish have to die? And why did Moshe warn Paro in advance about this detail? Moshe was warning Paro, Rav Chaim explains, not only that there would be a plague, but that it would be obvious that it was sent by Hashem. If the river turned to blood, was simply done by the magicians and the necromancers in Egypt, the fish in the river would not die. They would be able to somehow magically turn the water into blood, but not affect, it would be done through sorcery, not affect the fish. Only if the plague was sent by Hashem, Rav Chaim says, it would be proof that the fish died and it was truly by Hashem, because we know that the magicians were able to replicate the plagues, replicate the signs. It's only when we come to Kinim that they say, Etzba Elokim Hi, like Rabbi Pesach Kron tells over, Etzba Elokim Hi, Etzba stands for Ein Sarich Bedika Od. That's in the Rabbi Pesach Kron Haggadah. When it comes to the matah, to the nachash, they could do it. When it comes to water, to blood, they could do it. When it comes to tzvardeya, they're not impressed, they could do it. When it comes to kinim, something smaller than a barley, says Rashi to Chumash, ah, etzba lo kimi ein sarich bedika od. So the fact that they could also take a cup of water and turn it to blood doesn't prove it's God. But if all the fish also die, this is an integral part of the makah. So Rav Chaim is explaining, it's not just a byproduct of the makah. That's what I'm trying to say. It's not just a consequence of the makah. It's integral to the makah itself. A, the water turned to blood, and B, all the life in the water died. Both of these prove it is directly from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Furthermore, the Medrash tells us that when the water in Egypt turned to blood, so the Egyptians had nothing to drink. How could they get anything to drink? Rashi tells us it lasted for 7 days. They should forget Malchus Bechoros, forget Kriyas Yamsuf. They should have all died by Makah of Dam if there's nothing to drink. So even the water and the trees and the stones that were pooled turned to blood. So how did they have water to drink? So the Medrash says if they bought water from the Jews, from the Israelites, then they would have something to drink. So very nice, so the Jews became rich. But there's a kasha, Rav Chaim asks, the Gemara Masechus Tainis teaches one may not profit from a miracle. If one may not profit from a miracle, how were the Jews allowed to profit from Makas Dam? The only way that the Egyptians had water and therefore survived that week was by buying the water. But does that mean that the Jews are profiting from the water? And if so, they're not, profiting from the water, then they're profiting from the miracle. And the Gemara says that that's not allowed. Rav Chaim answers as follows. The miracle of the plague was that the water of the Egyptians turned to blood. The Mayim turned to Dam. The fact that the water of the Jews remained as water was not a miracle. It's a big chiddush. It's not a miracle that the Jews had water. It was natural that the Jews had water. It's Teva that the Jews had water. The Nes was that the Egyptians had blood. Their water was simply unaffected by the plague. And therefore, quote, following the natural course of events, it remained water. Therefore, the Jews were permitted to charge money for the water. They were not profiting from the actual miracle. So two insights into Dom. One, the fish dying proves this is Yad Hashem and not the magicians. And two, Avakasha, how could the Jews profit from a miracle? Well, Maisa, they were not profiting from a miracle. Their water stayed naturally water. They were selling their water, which you're allowed to do. Now we move to Tzfardeya. I think I'll come to one of my favorite every year. My Parshas Va'era, my son says, Mommy, it's your favorite Tvartar of the Stipler. And it's certainly my favorite Tvartar on the Makos. And it might not be new for you. It's not new for me. So far, everything that I've taught you is all new for me, what I prepared. This is not, but I'm including it because it's Gevaldik and so important. And it comes to us in the name of the Stipler, Rav Chaim Kotz, in the name of his father, Zecher Chatzadik Mekdoshim Levracha. So the Medrash teaches us, and I'm sure you all know this, that when the Makkah of the Psukim tell us, when the Makkah of frogs started in Paraches, I believe, of Shemos, there was one frog. Vata'al Hatzvardeya. There was one frog. So how could it be if there was one huge frog, like Rashi says, that all of a sudden the whole Egypt was covered with frogs? Where did all the frogs come from? There was only one frog. The Chumash is very careful in the Lashon. Vata'al Hatzvardeya turned into frogs in the ovens, and the furnaces, and the beds, and the kneading bowls, and the sleeping quarters. How did that happen? And their intestines, they were croaking from inside. There was one frog. So Rashi tells us, if you remember the famous Rashi Darshins, and says there was Taka, one frog, one huge frog. The Egyptians were hitting the frog. And as they hit it, little frogs kept jumping out. That's what Rashi says. What does the Stipler say? Zuk the Stipler. Rav Chaim often expands in the name of his father, the Stipler Gaon, Rav Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky Zecher Tzadik Kadosh Levracha. Again, you might be familiar with this. Ayan, I love it. The Egyptians hit the single frog. And every single time they hit the single frog, it spit out more frogs. Why didn't they just stop hitting the frog? It's very simple. Don't hit the frog. You won't have a plague. So there's one big frog. Ignore him. He's making a lot of noise, whatever. A million little frogs are going to make a lot more noise. It would have stopped spitting out the frogs. They could have avoided the entire plague. They brought it upon themselves. Why are you hitting the frog? Stop hitting the frog. It's one frog. Ignore him. He'll go away. He'll get bored. This episode teaches us a basic lesson about human nature. Mamish, every precious bow. My son says, not bow. Sorry, that's the last three makos. Va'era, mommy, it's your favorite var from the Stipler. When the Egyptians were hitting the frog, they were angry. And their anger took over. Logically, they should have stopped hitting the frog. But their anger blinded them. And they weren't able to think straight. Each time another frog appeared, they were more enraged. And they hit the frog again. And in the end, through their chaos, the entire country was covered with frogs. Often, quote, anger blinds us in a similar manner to the Egyptians. When people get into a fight, and I'm quoting, logic demands stop fighting before it causes further damage. Don't let it grow out of control. Don't blow things out of proportion. Calm down. Stop. Walk away. Take a breather. Ignore her for a few minutes and see what will happen. However, such is the blinding power of rage that in anger, people keep on hitting, whether proverbial or chas v'shalom, literally causing more and more problems that could easily have been avoided had they only stopped the hitting earlier. I don't even need to comment. Dom, the fish death, proved that God was behind the miracle. Furthermore, could the Israelites benefit from a miracle? No, but they weren't benefiting from a miracle, says Rav Chaim. Why? Because their water stayed water. That's nature. That's not a miracle. The miracle was that the Egyptians had blood. That's it. Theirs wasn't a miracle. It was Teva. Frogs, Tzvardeya, don't lose yourself to anger. Because when chaos takes over, we do the most irrational, self-inflicting, harmful, damaging to ourselves and others actions that we would never have done if we remained logical. If you don't want the plague of frogs, just stop hitting the frog. And there won't be a plague. It was completely irrational. Says the stipler, what's the problem? When rage takes over, man becomes completely irrational and is not thinking clearly anymore. Moving on to Dayenu. In Dayenu, we mention the man. Okay? Ilu hachilanu es haman, velona sananu es haShabbos, Dayenu. Had he fed us the man and not given us the Shabbos, Dayenu, man was the miraculous food that sustained the Israelites in the desert for 40 years of their sojourn. We had nothing else to eat, and God fed us manna from Shemayim. Falls for the first time in Parshas Beshalach, by the way, Parak Tazayin. Beshalach is still part of the story, B'tzias Mitzrayim. Shmos ve'era bo, Shmos is the Shibur, I'm meeting Moshe, ve'era bo, first 7 makos and last 3 makos respectively. Parshas bo, by the way, is what we read for Parshas HaChodesh this Shabbos. Parshas Bo, Perek Yud Beis, Psukim Aleph through Chaf, about Rosh Chodesh and the Korban Pesach, and Yitzias Mitzrayim is this week, Kriyas HaTorah. From the additional Sefer Torah, B'Shalach, the Shvi Shal Pesach, what we've already been speaking about, Kriyas Yam Suf, and in Perek Tazayin, the man falls for the first time. Okay, and we mention the man in Dayenu, and we thank Hashem for the miraculous man. The Gemara states in Maseches Brachos, listen to Rechaim reasoning and godless to understand what was the bracha on man, and how do we determine what the appropriate bracha was. The Gemara states in Maseches Brachos that the Jews would recite Birkas HaMazon after eating the man. So they finished their meal, they ate the man, they would bench, what we call benching. Birkas HaMazon is usually said after eating bread, since bread is the only food that fully satisfies a person. As the Gemara says, the manna was as satisfying as bread, even though it wasn't bread like we understand bread. It was, I don't know, we don't know exactly what it looked like. I never saw it. But it wasn't bread like you think of bread. It wasn't, you know, made out of flour and water and oil and eggs and sugar and whatever else you put into your particular recipe and yeast. It was man. But the man was as satisfying as bread. Thus, Birkas HaMazon was said after eating it. Rav Chaim wonders, the sages teach that the man's taste would change to taste like almost anything a person wished. So I'm sure we've all heard that, we're aware of that, the man tasted like anything you wanted. Did the essence of the man change as well as the taste? Was it only that the taste changed? The taste changed? Or did the man itself change? It's a difference. Was it the exact same item, but the taste changed? Or whatever you imagine it tasted like, it changed into some form of that thing, and the essence changed. It's not the same. Did the essence of the man change as well as the taste? The answer, says Rav Chaim, will determine when Birkas HaMazon was said. If it was only that the taste changed, so in other words, the essence stayed the same, but sometimes you could have steak, sometimes you could have pizza, sometimes you could have a loaf of bread, and sometimes you could have a salad. If it was only that the taste changed, not the essence, then Birkas HaMazon would always be said after eating it, because it would be as satisfying as bread. It wasn't bread, but it would be as satisfying as bread. The taste changed the bread. This is as satisfying as eating a good crusty loaf dipped in rosemary, garlic, olive oil. However, if the essence of the man would change as well, so it changed into steak, it changed into salad, it changed into bread, it changed into a donut, then Birkas HaMazon would only be said when it was being eaten as bread. For then it would only satisfy like bread when it changed into bread. If the taste only changed, but the man stayed the same the whole time, then you would recite Birkas HaMazon when you imagined it tasted like bread. But if the essence of the man changed, then you would only recite Birkas HaMazon when what? When you imagined bread and it tasted and changed into an essence of bread, because that's when it only satisfied like bread. If it was being eaten with the taste of another less satisfying food, its essence would also be less satisfying, and Birkas HaMazon would not be said. So here we go. The taste of man changed. It would resemble many foods, but it didn't taste like, if anybody remembers from Bamidbar Perek Yud Aleph, Rashi tells us, it didn't taste like cucumbers or melons or leeks or onions or garlic. Why not? Because Rashi says that it's unhealthy for a nursing woman, and therefore nursing woman would not want to absorb the taste of cucumbers, melon, leeks, onion, or garlic. It would not be good for their babies. Now, says Rav Chaim, it is not the taste of the foods that's harmful. It's not tasting cucumbers that's harmful to a nursing mother. It's what? Eating a cucumber. It's not tasting onion. So, I don't know. If you to eat potato chips that are onion garlic chips, okay? They taste like onion. They made them so. Oh, no, better example. Jelly bellies. Much better example. Jelly Belly's jelly beans. I don't know how they make them, but they have an uncanny resemblance to the food that they taste like. So what's harmful to the mother? Eating a Jelly Belly that tastes like leek and onion? Why would you want to eat that? I don't know, but they have, you know, they have the bamboozled boxes where it could either taste like blueberry or stinky feet. So let's say it tastes like onions and leeks, but it's a Jelly Belly. Is it dangerous to a nursing mother? No. What's dangerous to the nursing mother is the onion and the garlic itself, eating the food itself, not something that tastes like the food. So now we could answer the kasha. It is not the taste of food that's harmful. It's the food itself. The Jelly Belly is not harmful to the nursing mother. It's eating a salad made of cucumber, melon, leek, onion, and garlic that's harmful to the nursing mother, not the taste, the actual food. If it was only the mom's taste that changed, it could have changed into these foods. It would have caused no harm. If only the flavor of the mant changed to leeks and garlics, but its essence remained the same, it wouldn't be dangerous for nursing mothers. Why? It would be like eating Jelly Bellies on a different flavors. But the essence was the same. The essence was mant. The essence was not dangerous. The fact that the mant could not change into leeks, cucumbers, melon, garlic, onion, proves the essence of the man, says Rav Chaim, changed as well as the taste. Because it was just the taste, and we don't care if it went to those foods or not. The fact that it was dangerous to nursing mothers means the essence of the man changed with the food that you wanted it to taste like. It actually assumed the qualities of whatever food it became, which is a very, very teeny tiny example of the line of reasoning of a Gadol B'Torah. How we come to the conclusion. And also, I never knew that about the man. I always thought that the man stayed one way, and it just tasted like whatever you want it to taste like. But based on this line of reasoning, this whole darshaning, no, says Rav Chaim, it actually assumed the quantities of what you wanted it to become. Otherwise, it could become like leeks and garlics. The essence would be the same. It would be eating a Jelly Belly. No, it changed. Therefore, it did not turn into foods that would cause harm to nursing mothers. Based on this reasons, Rav Chaim, we can assume the Jews said Birkas HaMazon on the man only when they ate it as bread, because only then it was like bread, only then it satisfied like bread, and only then could Birkas HaMazon actually be recited. Beautiful. Ilu Hachilanu Es HaMan V'lo Nasanlenu Es HaShabbos Dayenu. Maror. Okay. Not only do we eat the mar, Pesach kol shalom marshosh dvarim elu lo yatsa dechavaso ve'elu heim Pesach masa umaror b'shash muchanachin lefanecha. We eat mar. Not only do we eat mar on Leil HaSeder, but we make a bracha on the mar. Gevaldik, let me bless you, God. Life's so bitter, fantastic. Have some mar. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Asher Kedushanu V'Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu Al Achilas Mar. How does the korban Pesach have to be eaten? Al matzos umirorim yochluhu. Rav Chaim cites Rav Akiva Eger, a person should be extremely careful to eat the matzah and maror. We have the opportunity to fulfill these mitzvahs only once a year, and one must be careful to eat the kezayis, which is the minimum amount required. Excuse me. If he eats even a little bit less than the amount, he has not fulfilled the mitzvah. He will not have the opportunity to fulfill it for a whole other year. Rav Akiva Eger continues and says, I guarantee, if a person eats the mar with true passion and joy on having the opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah, he will not taste the bitterness of mar at all. Now, mar is bitter. So how could it be you don't taste the bitterness? If it's bitter, it's bitter. If it's not, it's not. How could Rabbi Akiva Eger say, if you fulfill the mitzvah with joy, you won't taste the bitter? Rav Chaim was asked, we eat the mar because it tastes bitter, to remind us of the bitterness of our ancestors. Vayimaruru es chayehim ba'avod akasha b'chomer u'b'levenim v'chol avodasam asher avdu b'am b'farach. We spoke about farach already. We're supposed to taste the bitterness. It's part of the mitzvah. How could Rabbi Akiva Eger say a person doing the mitzvah properly will not taste the bitterness of the marah? You're supposed to taste the marah because it's recalling the bitterness of the Jews in Egypt. Rav Chaim answers that Rabbi Akiva Eger is not promising a person eating mar will miraculously not taste the mar. Rather, a person will be so overjoyed by the mitzvah that the bitterness will not bother him at all. I think that this is also a beautiful Mesor Haskel. Sometimes things in life are difficult for us. We have nisyonos. Not all mitzvahs are physically maybe so easy. Okay, fasting on Yom Kippur for 26 hours. Maybe some people are good fasters, and for some people it's a difficult mitzvah. It's not physically an easy mitzvah. There are certain mitzvos that might be difficult for us, and there are certain times in life that we find are difficult for us. It doesn't mean that a person won't taste the bitter, but you will have so much joy from knowing you are doing Ratzon Hashem that you could even make a bracha, and the bitterness in life won't necessarily bother you as much because you know that this is God's will. Yasar Yisrani Kavila Mavis Lo Nisanani, which we say in Hallel all the way at the end. So I got through more than last week in terms of the insights. Still not everything, but okay, Ezra Hashem, there is still next week. So I want to thank tonight's sponsors, Alice Marks, Lezeich Nishma Shmuel Ben Yaakov, Alav Hashem, the 38th yahrzeit of her father was 19 Adar Bet. I want to thank Susie Fonfetter, the second sponsor, Lezeich Nishmas, her father, Yehuda Ben Moshe, whose yahrzeit is upcoming on second day of Nisan, which is after Shabbos. And also, I want to thank very much Shana Pollock for dedicating this year in honor of a Simcha Baruch Hashem, in honor of the new baby boy born to the family, Shetizku Legado, the Torah, the Chupa, the Maisim Tovim. I look very much forward to continuing next week, which will be our last year before we break for Yom Tov. I wish everybody a good Shabbos and a Chodesh Tov. Thank you so much. Kol Tov. We will continue next week. Laila Tov to all. Thank you so much.